This is the takeaway for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
The National Weather Service put red flag warnings up across much of the state. That's for low humidities and high winds. And we combine that with the extremely dry vegetative conditions that we have. Every spark is going to ignite a fire.
Our primary objective is structure protection and just trying to stop the spread of the fire into the adjacent houses.
Primary focus continues to be on life safety. At this time, we do not know the number of evacuees that we had.
It's gone. Everything, you know, we were out busy. We managed to save our dogs and stuff, but that's it. We got the clothes on our back.
We haven't seen anybody. There's not much they can. There's so much going on that, you know, the resources are short.
I'm as frustrated as all of you at the scarcity of information that we have at this point.
We will be making arrests if there are looters. We're already starting to see that problem, so we will enforce the law. Stay out of the burn area, stay out of the evacuated areas.
We need the wind to die down. We need to get the aircraft overhead. We need to get the resources on scene and so we can slow down the progress of this fire.
And we're going to need to hang together as we go through this.
Voices from residents and authorities as deadly wildfires again ripped across Northern California on Sunday, burning more than 100,000 acres in the region's wine country. Multiple fires are still burning across Sonoma, Napa, and Mendocino counties north of San Francisco, forcing tens of thousands of people to evacuate and destroying 1,500 structures, including mobile parks, homes, and wineries. At least 10 people have died. Dozens more went to hospitals for fire and smoke-related injuries. About 100 people have been reported missing as well, but the cause of the fire is still unknown. John Sepulvedo is the host of the California Report, and he was in Santa Rosa yesterday, which sustained heavy damage. John, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
What did you see in Santa Rosa when you were there?
I saw a mess. It was a hellscape. It is a hellscape. I saw homes that were completely leveled, pipes exposed. There were gas pipes that were still turned on. So reminiscent of, you know, kind of oil derricks that they can't shut off. They're just burning gas, flames. I saw a 20-foot high flame at one gas valve. The authorities have to let them burn because if they don't, the fire could travel underneath and blow up the entire town and the tanks underneath. It's just an incredibly scary situation. I saw a hotel burn to the ground, the Hilton. Just surreal experience watching firefighters. We heard in that montage you were playing the lack of resources. They have 300 firefighters in Napa. I was somewhere around that same neighborhood in Santa Rosa, which is adjacent. And they have to decide, because there are so many fires burning at once, firefighters have to decide, can we save this? Can we do it in a way that will not cause any injury to firefighters? And of course, if there's the potential loss of life, they're not going to do it. Or if they need to save someone, rescue someone, they will do that as well. But that puts firefighters in the situation where they're letting structures burn. I mean, it's just a surreal situation.
And with so much work in an overwhelming fire for firefighters, John, are reinforcements pouring in from other jurisdictions or other states?
Yeah, so Kern County, I saw one firefighting truck from Kern County yesterday, which that is a haul. That's like driving somewhere like from Tennessee to Philadelphia, somewhere in that vicinity. So we're talking a large stretch of land, and we're expecting more folks to come. But even that, we don't. It's almost impossible to say because there are so many fires burning at the same time in very suburban, I would describe them, areas. I mean, some of these are towns and cities, but for the most part, think tract homes, think mobile home parks, think, you know, a little bit of space. There is a lot of ground to cover, but a lot to burn. And it is just a scary situation where it doesn't seem that the whole National Guard could be called in, which I believe it has been. Don't quote me on that. And I still don't think they can get a handle on these fires. Some of the stuff is just going to have to burn.
Fires are burning out of control north of San Francisco in several counties known as the Wine Country, Napa County, Sonoma County, Mendocino, and others. Thousands of structured burns and homes as well. John Sepulvedo of the California Report, thanks for keeping an eye on it for us. We'll keep with you on this story.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, let's turn to Washington now, where the city is still reacting to public comments from retiring Republican Tennessee Senator Bob Corker. Corker is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's important, and he helped get President Donald Trump elected. But over the weekend, Corker's growing frustration with the president boiled over. Bob Corker complained that the president treats foreign policy like a reality show. He said the president doesn't understand the power of his own office and that the White House has become an adult daycare where national security aides struggle to control the president's behavior. The president reacted angrily, but reaction to Corker's comments have been less about the shock of what he said and more a question of how many Republicans agree with him. McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's author of The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay Coppins, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, McKay, once everybody got over what Bob Corker had to say about the president, there was this underlying message, you know, maybe he's saying what a lot of Republican senators are saying in private but afraid to say publicly. How did you take it?
I think that's absolutely right. Any reporter, and really any person, but any reporter who's spent time talking to Republicans on Capitol Hill over the past 8 or 9 months has heard versions of what Corker said in private for months. They've heard concerns about the president's not just temperament, but his kind of volatility, his ability to manage his emotions, the fear of how that could affect foreign policy, how that could spark various, you know, catastrophic consequences on the global stage. These are fears that and anxieties that Republicans in Congress have had for a long time, and we've seen some reporting about it. But Senator Corker has gone much further than anyone else in terms of going public with those concerns, and I think it's an important moment in this conversation about the president.
Well, what is this moment? Because you're right, McKay. Anybody who spends time around the Senate has heard these conversations, and then they turn around and they talk to their friends and colleagues about them, and the conversation turns to the fact that none of these criticisms that Bob Corker is talking about publicly are new because the president's behavior that led to them aren't new. I mean, Mitt Romney, before the campaign got into full swing, had much the same to say as Bob Corker. Even worse, Hillary Clinton said it. John Kasich, a Republican, said it. And there are many who now feel, you know, now you're realizing this. You helped elect him.
Right. And I think that that's a fair criticism. I think that we can take these criticisms seriously without handing out, you know, medals of valor for courage to Bob Corker or anyone else who's just now coming around to voicing them. I think that there has been a widespread theory among Republicans in the Senate and in Washington in general that I've heard that as worried as they are about the president's temperament, of his behavior, the kind of erratic nature of his actions, it's better for them to try to be on his side, to get as close to the White House as they can so that they can hopefully advise the president and influence him, get their legislative agenda passed, which is a big deal, and then also, frankly, you know, rein him in. And there's, I've heard many Republicans tell me, look, we're not going to accomplish anything with this president by going on TV and trashing him because we know how he'll react. That said, we've now seen this that idea be put to the test for about 9 months, and I don't think we've seen the president change at all. If anything, I think we've seen him lean in more to those behaviors that have so troubled Republican senators.
So, McKay, I said when I was introing you that Bob Corker's frustration has boiled over into public. I mean, is that really true, or do you see this as a calculated moment, a calculated tactic on the part of Republicans with Corker on point since he's retiring to go public with some of this?
Well, that's a good question. The Republican sources that I've talked to over the past 24 hours are split on this. Some say, you know, this is just a Republican senator who's a lame duck. He's nearing retirement and he's kind of able to say whatever he wants. But others say that Corker's this isn't an emotional decision by Corker. He's not just venting. There are genuine concerns by Corker. You said he's head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. There are general concerns among Republicans in Washington about how the president is acting with regards to North Korea. And they believe that the situation has gotten so bleak and so dire, and the threat of a potential conflict with North Korea has gotten so serious that it's time to take those concerns public and start litigating that in public. And Corker obviously was a credible figure to bring those arguments and those concerns public.
And the inevitable question after that, McKay Coppins, is what will other Republicans in the Senate do about it if it's true that so many of them have concerns like this? You got part of your answer. Lindsey Graham, who's heavy on national security issues, just like Bob Corker, tweeted over the weekend about how much fun he had at golf with the president and how good the president really is at golf. Seems like Lindsey Graham is taking a very different tactic.
Well, and I've heard Republicans speculate to me that they're doing kind of a good cop, bad cop thing here. That Corker is going to retire. He has no reason to cozy up to the president, but he can be out there making the case against Trump's behavior and his approach to North Korea, which then creates space for people like Lindsey Graham to come to the president and say, look, he's out of line. Let me work with you. And that's what a lot of Republicans say is the best case scenario for what could come out.
It's a sophisticated set of manipulations in public, if that's true, McKay Coppins, and might say a lot about the realities of Senate relations with the president of the United States. But one of the other realities is that the GOP has a two-seat majority. They desperately want tax reform. Obamacare repeal has failed. There are big fights over spending and immigration coming up. What does it mean to have a fight like this now between the Republican president and powerful Republicans on the Hill when they only have two votes to burn?
Well, look, this is one of the biggest frustrations that I've heard from Republicans about this whole thing, is that the president is unnecessarily alienating a key vote that Republicans absolutely need if they're going to get anything accomplished legislatively before they possibly lose control of the House or the Senate after next year's midterms. The president cannot be going around picking fights of a nasty personal nature with Republican senators right now. He needs their votes. He's obviously frustrated that they haven't been able to get anything done for him. Healthcare has been a failure. But you know, you talk to Republican leadership especially, and they'll say this is the most counterproductive thing the president could possibly do. And if he continues like this, it could effectively be the end of his presidency from a domestic policymaking standpoint.
And before we let you go, McKay Coppins, we've talked about Republicans on Republicans. That's what this is about. What have Democrats been saying to you as they watch this from the sidelines?
Oh, well, you know, Democrats are frankly gratified that Republicans like Corker are finally speaking up. I think they think it's about time. But, you know, we saw some Democrats just over the weekend come out and say, look, we need to take legislative action to rein in Trump's ability to start a conflict with North Korea. And Republicans who are worried about this need to get on board with that. That's what I hear most from Democrats.
McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay Coppins, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And now we turn back to the aftermath of last week's Las Vegas shooting by talking to somebody who lived through a different mass shooting. On January 8th, 2011, a gunman attacked a community outreach event hosted by Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords outside Tucson, Arizona. Pan Simon was shot in the chest by Jared Loughner that day. 13 people were wounded, including the congresswoman, and 6 were killed. Pam recovered physically, but we wanted to hear from her about the mental toll that surviving an attack like that can have. With so many lives taken in mass shootings since that day in 2011, Pam has had a lot of chances to reflect on what it means to live through one. In 2011, Pam Simon was a community outreach coordinator for then Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, and she takes us back to that day outside Tucson.
It was a crisp January morning, and we set up and we're getting ready to have another successful Congress in Your Corner. People had lined up and Gabby arrived. And as we all know, 10 minutes after she first started talking to constituents, a young man who with severe mental problems raced up, pulled out a gun and started shooting. And in a matter of just seconds, 13 people were wounded, 6 people lay dead, and I was laying flat down on the pavement, a bullet through my wrist that went straight into my chest, and by some miracle, it did not hit my heart or lungs, and I am here today.
Do you still have memories of the moment of the attack, watching others around you fall and falling to the pavement yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I never lost consciousness. And once I was on the pavement, what I remember is auditory, the sounds. A lot of times people will say I heard a lot of screaming in a situation like this. And what I remember is just the sound of people rushing to help. And voices kind of hushed as people rushed out of the Safeway, Good Samaritans, to stop the bleeding. And those Good Samaritans saved lives that day while they waited for first responders to arrive.
Well, in your case, Pam Simon, the physical wounds healed, and that's something I know that you and your family are thankful for. But in the months and years since, and even today, what types of things in your daily life just sort of flood back and remind you of the trauma of that day?
Well, PTSD, which almost anyone who's in a traumatic situation will have some degree of, post-traumatic stress syndrome, is different for everyone, but there are commonalities. One is the startle response stays for a long, long time, if not forever. A car backfiring or a balloon popping, that you get a startle response. And then your mind often plays kind of a recurring movie, which in time, with good counseling, you can learn to turn those movies off. So when you hear something like the horrible shooting in Las Vegas, it re-traumatizes. It does flood back your own experience. And the other thing is, you know, to some degree, that we sometimes call it terrible knowledge, what the others are going through. It causes you to step into that situation. And if I had been there, what would I have done? And you find yourself kind of going down a dark path that that it takes some effort to stop.
What have you learned about what an attack of the type that you survived means for the mental health of survivors like you?
We all are on our own timeline. People heal in different ways, just in the same way that people grieve differently. And it is, in a way, a grieving process. I am incredibly grateful that my physical wounds healed over, you know, a 6-7 month period. Still have some chipped ribs and that are sore at times, but everyone, even those that weren't touched by a bullet but saw the person beside them get shot in the head, they will never, ever be the same. Some of the things that were helpful for me, and as I watched my other survivors, holding friends, family, faith groups, community folks around you to begin to let them help you, but that was incredibly helpful to me. And I cannot stress how important it is to get professional help. Even if you just witnessed gun violence, that's a wound. And then not trying to do action immediately if you're not ready for it, but waiting to the time that you are strong enough to step out. But when you are, that made a big difference for me to be able to be part of a change. One of the things that I wanted to mention that has probably been more helpful than anything is the organization Every Town for Gun Safety has a survivor network, and it started with the January 8th survivors and families of the victims, and it has now grown into a survivor network that incorporates hundreds and hundreds of people who have gone through a fellowship program for some training on how to speak out, be part of the solution. As an organization overall, Every Town has grown to almost 3 million strong. But I just want to say that the Survivor Network has connected us with other survivors across the country. We support each other and we spur each other on. And we're going to be a voice, I think, that cannot be stopped.
You have a memento that you keep of that day, January 8th, 2011.
I do. It's sitting right here on the desk beside me. And that's the tiny piece of lead that went through my wrist and then into my chest and sailed through half of my body. And some people would say, doesn't that give you the creeps? And oddly, it went to the FBI for several years, and then they offered to give it back, and I was happy to take it because it is a memento that reminds me every day of how grateful I am to be here. Yesterday, my baby grandson was born in New York City, and to think how close, a quarter of an inch from my heart, that little piece of lead sailed, and how close I came to not being able to meet my grandchildren chokes me up to think about it.
Pam Simon worked for Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords in Arizona and was shot in the 2011 shooting that targeted Gabrielle Giffords outside of Tucson. Pam Simon, thank you for joining us and congratulations on your new grandson.
Thank you, Todd. It is a joy.
Well, we just heard from Pam Simon, a victim of a mass shooting in America. And of course, her story is not unique. The United States has more mass shootings than any other country. And the recent shooting in Las Vegas was the deadliest in modern American history. At least 58 people were killed, around 500 injured, plus hundreds more traumatized. Well, while survivors of mass shootings go through a range of psychological and emotional effects after the event, according to Dr. Carol North, not all of those effects are bad. North is a professor of psychiatry and a disaster mental health expert at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. She says the trauma of being in a mass shooting can stay with victims for years.
Well, immediately there's a fight or flight response with an incredible adrenaline surge, and that takes a bit of time to settle down. It may take days to weeks for those feelings to subside. People may be very jittery and jumpy or even irritable. They may have intrusive memories flood back to them like a videotape that plays over and over again and won't stop. And these reminders may be very upsetting. They may have trouble concentrating. They may have trouble sleeping. And these feelings tend to reduce quite a bit in the first days, weeks, and over the first month in most people.
How long can they take to resolve entirely?
These experiences can go on for weeks, months, and even years, particularly people who are developing post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. They may be unable to face reminders, and they may become avoidant, not want to go out, and their feelings may go numb. And these are the people that we become most concerned about, because PTSD, if it develops, can go on for years or even decades.
Now, you have said that some of the effects of PTSD or some of the trauma of a mass shooting in the aftermath isn't all bad, that it may not all be negative. What did you mean?
Anytime a person goes through something very difficult, very challenging, it's an opportunity to learn things, develop new skills, to grow and develop new perspectives on life and develop gratitude for things that maybe you hadn't thought so much about before.
And how does that manifest itself in your experience treating victims like this?
Well, some people have a sudden new sense of priorities in life, and they suddenly realize what's important, and they spend time with loved ones and think about how much it means to them, and they do the things that are most important to them and let things go that aren't as important. So that's, some people call this post-traumatic growth.
Dr. North, mass shootings are more common in this country than in any other country, but they are relatively rare. Is the type of treatment and assessment for PTSD and the psychological effects that this kind of trauma can bring a standard part of response to a mass shooting? I guess I'm wondering if that needs to be part of standard emergency or second-day response in a disaster like the one we saw in Las Vegas.
In the early days after a disaster, everybody is upset, so it's really hard to assess who is developing a psychiatric disorder or not. And it, according to the diagnostic criteria, it takes 4 weeks or a month before we can diagnose PTSD, and it takes 2 weeks before we can diagnose a new episode of major depressive disorder. So these things take a bit more time as the dust begins to settle to figure out what's going on.
Dr. Carol North, professor of psychiatry at UT Southwestern Medical Center, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We turn to the Harvey Weinstein story now. Many famous actresses came out over the weekend disavowing the Hollywood producer's decades of alleged sexual harassment, including names like Meryl Streep and Judi Dench. We spoke with Melissa Silverstein, publisher and founder of Women in Hollywood, and asked her for her takeaway on everything we know so far.
I'm taking away from this that it is a time that we've had a conversation about this on a global level, beyond kind of the whispers that go on, beyond people telling other people who to avoid. This is a industry-wide problem, and it's a problem beyond the Hollywood industry, and it needs to be discussed, and this issue needs to be reckoned with.
Obviously, his behavior over the years, aggressive and inappropriate, many, many settlements allegedly paid. And is the issue at this point the behavior of a powerful movie mogul, somebody like Harvey Weinstein or Roger Ailes for that matter, or is it the conspiracy of silence around him or both?
I actually think it's both. And I also think it's how many people are complicit with this and how many people, enabled him to go on for so long because it benefited them.
Some of the news last night, Matt Damon, Russell Crowe, big stars, helped push back on a story about Weinstein in the New York Times in 2004, helped kill that story. Every time another star comes out about this, there seems to be this conspiracy of silence that you're talking about. Jessica Chastain said she knew all along, and a lot of other people did too, and said nothing. Meryl Streep says she didn't know at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening now is people in this industry are kind of asking themselves, how have I been a part of it in any way? And really thinking about it in a way they've never had to do before. You know, this is an issue that people are going to struggle with, men and women. I think the men in this industry really need to step up and figure out how this doesn't happen again, how people who are predators now that are still within the industry get removed, how they have to step up. This industry is male-centric, male-powerful industry. This is not on the women. This is not on blaming the women who stood out. This is on the men in power to make this change.
And what do you see here as the root of the cause of the silence? Is it just simple self-interest? Harvey Weinstein was too important, too rich, bankrolled too many movies, and nobody wanted to damage their careers.
I think people were afraid. It's a culture of fear, and they prey on that. And so if you're told, you know, if you say anything that you're never going to work again, you believe that. Because again, it's about the dynamics of power. Sexual harassment is about power, and we just can't forget that.
What did you make of the news that big stars Matt Damon and Russell Crowe in 2004 helped to kill a story that journalist Sharon Waxman says could have exposed Harvey Weinstein much, much earlier?
I don't have any details on that except from what I've read, and all I can say is that if they did that, shame on them.
Shame on them, but if true, what does that kind of behavior from other powerful people, powerful actors, say to you about the culture around somebody like Harvey Weinstein?
It says that he was able to convince people that it wasn't true, and because we've spent most of our history not believing women, it was able to be done probably pretty easily.
So where does this story need to go for you, Melissa Silverstein, to be, I guess, to be productive in the end?
Well, I think what needs to happen in this industry is that, people who have powerful positions need to step up. And when people see this behavior, they need to be able to call people out on it and not face repercussions. And I also believe that we need to employ more women at all levels of the business, because I think that would help dealing with the fact that everything is dominated by men.
Melissa Silverstein, thank you for being here.
You are welcome.
Melissa Silverstein is founder and publisher of Women in Hollywood and co-founder of the Athena Film Festival. Today in Ukraine, influence and conflict with Russia continues to dominate that Eastern European country. But Russia's power over its smaller neighbor to the west has a long history. Beginning in 1932, at least 5 million Ukrainians died because of famine. There was drought at the time and the chaos of forced collectivization from Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union. The Soviets took steps to cover up the details of the famine, but newly opened archives and personal accounts have revealed to the West what many families in Ukraine had been forbidden to talk about for generations, that the famine was no accident. It was deliberate policy set in motion by Stalin and his supporters to weaken Ukraine and break its national will. Ann Applebaum is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, a columnist for The Washington Post, and author of the new book, Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine.
People did speak about it privately, it has to be said, and the stories were passed down, you know, through families and so on. Many Ukrainians were able to leave the country during the Second World War, and many of them moved to Western Europe and North America, where they would hold famine commemorations, and they tried to put together collections of essays and memoirs about it. But really, it seemed incredible to people that something like that could have really happened.
So much of your book centers on 1932. The warnings are pouring in from party officials all over the country to Stalin. Ukraine is starving, they tell him. But this wasn't accidental. In fact, this was strategy.
You're absolutely right. It was not an accident. In the autumn of 1932, the Soviet Politburo took a series of decisions designed to make the famine worse in Ukraine. They included drawing a cordon around Ukraine so that people couldn't leave. They included blacklisting particular towns and villages. And above all, the one policy that was carried out in Ukraine and in very few other places was a decision to send activist teams into villages. So groups of people went house to house and literally confiscated people's food. They took it away and left them with nothing.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit more, because on the one hand, forced collectivization was the rule of the day, the ideology of the Soviet communists. But this other thing that you're talking about is using famine to really stamp out Ukrainian identity.
The Ukrainian national movement had been a problem for the Soviet Union from the very beginning. In 1917, when the Bolshevik Revolution broke out, there was also a revolution in Ukraine, and it was led by the Ukrainian national intelligentsia, and their goal was to create a Ukrainian state. And they were actually at war with the Bolsheviks. And Stalin remembered that period, particularly because collectivization led to a further rebellion in Ukraine. And he saw that this problem of Ukraine wanting to reassert itself, to have a different identity, not to be part of the Soviet Union in quite the same way as other republics, was going to go on being a problem for him. And he decided to eliminate it. And he did so by weakening the peasants, and I should say also by launching an attack on the Ukrainian intelligentsia, the politicians, museum curators, architects, artists, writers, in a mass arrest that took place at the same time as the famine and immediately afterwards. So these were really two-pronged assault on the Ukrainian state and on the Ukrainian nation, designed to make sure that it never posed an ideological threat to Moscow ever again.
So how did Ukraine eventually get out from under this famine? Why didn't it go on for 20 years?
Well, the famine ended because the Soviet state decided to end it. The goal was never to destroy or kill all Ukrainians. As I said, the goal was to weaken the national movement and to weaken the peasants' desire for resistance.
You say Stalin in 1932 twisted the knife in Ukraine. The Soviet leadership launched a famine within a famine, a disaster specifically targeted at Ukraine and Ukrainians. The result, the Ukrainian national movement disappeared completely from Soviet politics and from public life. This was effective.
It was effective. It eliminated Ukraine for the lifetime of the Soviet Union, though it's important to remember that in the 1980s, when the Soviet Union began to fall apart and when Gorbachev started carrying out reforms, one of the first things that happened was that Ukrainians remembered the national movement and they remembered this piece of history and they started talking about the famine in public again. It was the memory of the past. It was also the memory of the Soviet assault on the Ukrainian intelligentsia that people had kept alive in various ways, and that came back and became a big topic of national debate. And that was one of the things that led to the Ukrainian independence movement of 1990-1991, which eventually declared independence and was actually, as Stalin had feared, the factor that brought a real end to the Soviet Union. It was the Ukrainian refusal to join Russia and the other republics that persuaded Russia to abandon the idea of keeping the USSR together.
What does the Red Famine and the history there and the Russian assault on Ukrainian peasants and Ukrainian society tell us about the Russian government today, about Vladimir Putin today and Russian clients in Ukraine today?
So the current Russian government still tends to see Ukraine the way that Moscow has seen Ukraine for many decades, and that is as a kind of colony. It's not a real country. It doesn't deserve to have its own status. It can't make its own policy. It can't decide to sign a free trade agreement with Europe, for example. And in a real way, I think Putin, like Stalin before him, sees Ukraine as a problem and an ideological challenge that he needs to suppress. Stalin saw Ukraine as a source of anarchy and maybe as a challenge to Soviet unity. And Putin sees Ukraine as problematic because of Ukraine's attachment to the West, because there's an important pro-democracy movement in Ukraine. And that thing that he saw happening in Ukraine in Kiev in 2014, namely lots of young people waving EU flags, shouting anti-corruption slogans and calling for democracy, that's exactly what he's afraid of in Moscow, and why he still continues to try to undermine Ukraine in all kinds of ways, you know, propaganda ways and economic ways even today.
What might the lesson be for people in the West and for Vladimir Putin himself and the Russian government from this history that you write about on how this new round of influence in Ukraine might turn out?
I don't ever like to draw an exact parallel between the past and the present, but I think it's a mistake to underestimate the Ukrainianness of Ukraine. You know, it's a real country. It has its own identity. It has a real language. And it also has a very powerful kind of pro-European, pro-democratic tradition that it will fight to uphold, as it has already shown. And it is wrong to underestimate it as some kind of colony or province of Russia. And then on the other hand, remember that the disinformation, the attempts to manipulate the story of Ukraine that we're seeing coming out of Russia, the lies that are told about what's happened in Ukraine. You know, there's a long precedent for that. And again, I don't want to draw an exact parallel, but, you know, when dictators try to change reality or alter reality, they often do it with violence in mind.
Anne Applebaum, columnist for The Washington Post, author of the new book, Red Famine, Stalin's War on Ukraine. Anne, it's always good to have you on.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. After the Red Famine of 1932 that we were just talking about with Anne Applebaum, Stalin's Russia was on the eve of war with Germany. By 1941, the Red Army was fighting Hitler in Eastern Europe, and on the other side of the world, American sailors and Marines began to move across the Pacific to fight the Japanese Navy. But as they did, the U.S. Army and the Navy began a secret project recruiting women. They advertised at women's colleges and even dispatched handsome young soldiers across the country to find single women willing to move to Washington, D.C. and become codebreakers. Author and journalist Liza Mundy was floored to learn that women made up more than 70% of the domestic codebreakers during World War II. But because the work was top secret, she could barely find any mention of these contributions. Liza Mundy wanted to recognize the work of these thousands of women, so she decided to write a book about it. It's called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II, and it comes out today.
The women were very patriotic, and it was so interesting. I interviewed a lot of the women in person. I spent a lot of time in assisted living facilities talking to women about the incredible patriotism during the war. I mean, they talked about how, you know, everybody was on board together. Everybody wanted to serve the war. One of the main characters in my book, Dot Braden, who was a young school teacher in Chatham, Virginia, her family, her brothers were both fighting. The women wanted to help the war effort as well. Her family had actually written the military to volunteer their dog, Poochie, to serve the war effort as well. Unfortunately, Poochie was too old, but Dot was, you know, she was very eager to serve her country the way that her brothers were. She was also interested in getting out of an engagement that she was not really that keen on. And she had never been to Washington. It was incredibly exciting to contemplate coming to what was really the beating heart of the free world at that point. And Washington, you know, filled up with these women. So, although they were incognito and doing clandestine work that they could not talk about and did not talk about.
But how does a school teacher from Charleston, South Carolina, or a fourth-year undergrad from Smith College break a Japanese code if she doesn't speak Japanese?
Well, it really doesn't matter what the underlying language is. If you have a code group for maru, which was the Japanese word for a commercial ship, it might be carrying medicine or troops or food or oil. And if that's rendered into, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, it doesn't matter that the Japanese word is maru. You just need to know that that code group stands for commercial ship. What was really extraordinary, I interviewed a woman on Cape Cod from Smith College. She was in her mid-90s when I was interviewing her, and she explained to me how they did that. She still remembered it. And they would look for common words like noon position, and they would learn where in the message that would be likely to appear, and that would help them ascertain what some of the code groups might be for noon position. And so they found all sorts of ways to sort of jiggle around. And there's a lot of conjecture and guessing involved. And then at a certain point, there's also a lot of math. Hmm.
So Liza Mundy, what's an example then of a Japanese operation thwarted or an attack thwarted or an American operation that was successful because of the code girls?
Right. The Battle of Midway was it's one of the most famous battles of World War II, a sea battle where American ships were both outnumbered and were going to be ambushed at Midway. And through extraordinary code breaking, the Americans found out about this purported ambush by the Japanese and were able to be in the right place at the right time and beat back the Japanese. And one of the reasons that we could break that code was because of the work of a woman, a mathematician named Agnes Driscoll, who had worked during the 1930s to master the secrets of the Japanese fleet code. So we knew how the Japanese fleet code worked. Even though it periodically changed its code books, it still worked the same way. So thanks to her brain work all during the 1930s and to men in the field, we were able to break that code at the Battle of Midway. And also something that is less dramatic than the Battle of Midway, but very important. Because of the work that the school teachers were doing in the Army facility, we were able to anticipate the movements of all these Japanese supply ships, the marus that were carrying troops, oil, food, fuel, animals, medical supplies, veterinary supplies, and sink them over and over and over again.
Well, Liza Mundy, this was a secret program, of course, and that makes sense. And nobody talked about it for many years, and that makes sense, too. How did you find out about it?
Yeah, that's a complicated story. And I would like to stress that these women, it was made clear to them over and over and over again that they could not say anything about what they were doing. And the reason it was so easy for women to get away with the secret is because people just assumed that women were secretaries and they wouldn't be doing important work. So they would literally say, I sharpen pencils, I fill inkwells, I give the commander what he needs. And people would believe that. And I should say, you know, it hasn't been ignored. There is a display at the Cryptologic Museum on women code breakers. And many of the sweeping dramatic histories of code breaking during the war will mention, sometimes literally in a parenthetical, that, oh, by the way, a lot of this work was done by women. But it's just striking that the histories would then go on really to just talk about the work that the men had done, often like naval officers who were out there in the Pacific and sometimes wrote their own memoirs and acquired sort of a legendary status. And all that's deserved. But I do feel as though some of the historians writing this would also make the assumption that whatever the women did, it probably wasn't that important. But when I started looking at the National Archives into the literally thousands of file boxes that they have there, I didn't know how much there would be. I thought maybe I would spend a week at the National Archives in College Park, and I ended up spending months there because the material was so rich and there were so many reports, and it was so clear that any number of times significant breaks were made by women. I mean, how could they not be when in the end the women were basically running the shops here in Washington?
The book is Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. Liza Mundy is the author. It's been great having you.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
And here's a final take for you today. If you missed our show yesterday on Columbus Day, we did a full hour special on the opioids crisis in America. You can find that show on our website at thetakeaway.org or find us on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll be continuing our coverage of opioids in America. So we asked you, what parts of this crisis do you want to see us cover?
Hi, my name is Emily. I'm calling from El Cerrito, California. I'd like to suggest that you cover the related increases in hepatitis C among people under 30 years of age. We're seeing an epidemic of hepatitis C in young people across the country.
My name is Judy Reynolds, and I live in Grants Pass, Oregon. In regard to the opioid epidemic among middle America, there should be some mention of the difference in the approach to how we're treating white people today who are hooked on drugs in comparison to how we looked upon black people.
You can give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. And again, you can listen back to our full hour coverage on opioids in America that we aired yesterday here on The Takeaway. And on a happier note, we want to give a huge congratulations from all of us here at The Takeaway to our boss, executive producer Irva Gunja. She got married this weekend, so congratulations to Irva and to her new husband, Oz. We're so happy for the new couple, and we wish you all the best. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo, offering print products with features like Printfinity, a technology that gives the ability to print a different image on every business card. Learn more at Moo.com. And AliveCor, working to make heart monitoring simple, continuous, and digital. AliveCor's cardia devices deliver EKGs and detect atrial fibrillation right from the user's fingertips from anywhere. More at AliveCor.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.